Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. I have got a treat for you right now. My good friend Lynn Alden just came out with another sensational blog post, and we're going to review it right here, right now. This is going to absolutely blow your mind. So guys, sit down, pour yourself that stiff drink, and let's get right into her amazing content. This is really, you guys are going to love this. I'm super excited. So let's get into it. I highlighted certain parts. As you guys know, Lynn's blog posts are usually like 10,000 word deep dive novels. I mean, they're incredible. This one is just as awesome as all the others she has. And it's something that's super relevant to what's going on in macro right now. And that's the fact that the United States debt is now over $30 trillion. And that's on balance sheet debt. That doesn't include all the off balance sheet debt, which probably takes it up over, let's call it $150 trillion, just to be conservative. So Lynn poses the question, does this matter? I mean, we look at Japan and their debt to GDP, let's call it 250%. So that's higher than ours at 130, but are there different circumstances there? Let's get into our article here, and I'm going to explain this to you guys. And we're going to learn a lot together. So here's the article from my good friend and business partner, Lynn Alden. There she is. And so she poses the question, does national debt actually matter? And the first thing that she highlights is back in the good old days, money was gold and gold was physically scarce. Why that's important is because although there was, let's call it fractional reserve lending, where you would deposit your gold with XYZ Bank and they would give you IOUs for that gold, or they would they would lend other people IOUs against your gold. And so the important component there is that those IOUs were redeemable for something the bank could not create. That is the constraint, even within a fractional reserve system. There is a constraint there. Now what we have is a system where that IOU, that dollar you have in your pocket, or that dollar that you have in your checking account isn't redeemable for anything. Now, it is redeemable, and this matters at the end of the day. It is redeemable for a green piece of paper. And I know that green piece of paper is an IOU, nothing. Because it's not backed by gold, but at least that green piece of paper, in other words, cash, is something that the bank can't create, right? The Fed, maybe the Treasury, but the bank itself cannot create that. So to a certain degree, that gives it a little bit of a constraint, but not as much as we had with gold. And if you take away cash, if we go to a cashless society, which I think is the direction we're going, then the banks have zero constraint. Absolutely none. The only constraint they have, which Lynn points out correctly, is just basically their accounting principles. And some might say Basel III regulation. I don't even think that's a constraint because the banks are so clever, if that's the right word. I think they can get around any type of regulation they want to because they're so far ahead of the regulators themselves. So let's keep going down this article. And I'm going to skip over a lot of it here. I cannot recommend you guys reading this article enough. This is at her website, which is just for the people on the podcast listening. It's Lynn Alden, ALDEN.com. And this is just her most recent article. In the late 1960s, the global monetary system started to break down, again, because more paper claims were issued than there was gold in government vaults, not just paper, but digital. You know, so that's when we had the Eurodollar system that sprung up in the 1950s as a result of Bretton Woods. So this, as our good friend Snyder points out, Jeff Snyder, is a reserveless, cashless system. There are no bank reserves. And there could be, but mostly there's no bank reserves. There's no cash. It's not redeemable. If you have a $1 billion in your account with XYZ Cayman Island Bank, it's not like you can go there and get your $1 billion in green pieces of paper. So it's a system that exists in the shadows. the euro dollar system. And so what was happening here, one of the things that was happening, is there were all of these basically dollars that were created by the euro dollar system, and it far exceeded the 10%, let's just say, reserve requirement or something like that. So you get all these dollars that are flooding into the states that were created outside of the states, and like, whoa, time out. We don't have the gold for this. And there was a lot of domestic policy that went into that as well. But these factors contributed to us going off the quote-unquote gold standard, which was kind of fake in the first place, but in 1971. So let's keep reading here. So since 1971, Lynn points out that most countries have been on a fiat standard instead, meaning their currency isn't defined by or redeemable for anything. The government issues money and the people use the money. Throughout emerging markets, many of these fiat currencies have hyperinflated, but developed markets have been able to manage moderate inflation during that period and keep their unbacked currencies in use. And again, I want to point out there, guys, although I'm not a huge fan of fiat currency, it's better than having a cashless system, because with no cash whatsoever, that is the last thing that really constrains the banks, even though that has not been a constraint for the banks in the euro dollar system. So then she points out, in practice, inflation has been a lot more rapid since the shift towards modern central banking, especially since 1971. And look at this, guys. So this is $100, in 1792, adjusted for inflation. So what you would have today to equal $100 of purchasing power back in 1792. And I would assume this is even based on the CPI, which you guys know understates inflation significantly. Look at this. Before the Fed in 1913, $100 bought you more goods and services than it did in 1792. Just let that sink in for a moment, because we've been born and have lived in an environment with constant inflation. Even if they say, well, we're in a disinflationary period, okay, that's fine. But our currency is constantly being inflated away. It's just to what degree? That's really the only question. And since we've grown up in that system, we've got accustomed to it, we kind of make our financial decisions and a lot of the decisions in our normal lives based on this assumption, whether it's subconscious or conscious. But think about how your decision-making process would change, especially your financial decisions, if you knew that in 100 years, over 100 years, that the dollars you have today that you would give to your grandkids and your great-grandkids, and et cetera, would buy more stuff. I mean, that is such a fundamental shift. That is an absolute game changer on so many levels, right? So why? What? Well, we're on a gold standard. And I want to mention too, a lot of people say, oh, well, this fractional reserve system, we got to get rid of this. That's the whole, that's the devil. Not really. There's pros and cons there. I want to point out that we have had, during this whole time, we had fractional reserve banking. And as a matter of fact, from 1837 to the beginning of the Civil War, we had free banking, which means that banks were issuing their own currency right here in the United, or right there, I'm not in the US right now, but right in the United States. And look at what happened to the value of the dollar. During all of this fractional reserve and yada, 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 free banking, where there was no regulation, Krugman and all the central planning types would come out and say, oh my gosh, that would be disastrous. We can't trust the private sector to do money. No, that has to be centralized. Really? They did a pretty damn good job of it from 1792 to 1913. That's for sure. I mean, think about this. What's the job of the Fed? Sure to backstop the banking system, lender of last resort. Okay, we get it. But since, for the last, at least in our lifetimes, one of the main mandates of the Fed is to make sure that we have a stable currency, make sure the dollar, I don't want to say strong, but make sure the dollar doesn't lose too much purchasing power, make sure that it's stable. Well, look at this line right here. Does that look stable to you? What is stable about this? Nothing. This is parabolic. This from 1792 to 1913, that's stable. So what's the difference here? When we have massive inflation or lack of stability with the dollar, that's when the central planners were in charge. From here to here, when we had perfect stability in the dollar, that's when we had a decentralized approach and the private sector was running the show. Which would you prefer? I don't want to, I'm going off on a massive tangent right there, but I think it's a very good tangent. Let's keep going. Now I'm going back to Lynn here. And actually, let me make this a little bigger so you guys can see it. All right. For example, the U.S. Treasury can print a physical currency and coinage. The Federal Reserve, however, is the entity that distributes it. Paper dollars are technically liability of the Fed. Okay, we know this. Most currency only exists in commercial bank ledgers. It is lent into existence by the commercial banking system that have to operate within the confines of capital ratios and profitability. So the reason I highlighted that, because that goes back to what I was saying, is that unless if you have no cash, and that's barely a constraint. Outside the United States, I would say in the euro dollar system, it's never been a constraint. But in the United States, maybe there's an argument there. But without that cash, the only thing that confines the system or constrains the system would be these regulations, the capital ratios and profitability. And quite frankly, guys, without getting or going down the rabbit hole, I don't think even that would constrain the banking system. And you say, George, what do you mean profitability? Yeah, I mean profitability. Even that, I don't think would constrain the banking system. Because if we have a consolidation of the banking system, what is profitability for a bank? What is it? It's just simply gap accounting. So if we only have two banks, let's say taking it to an extreme, so we can get our head around it, why wouldn't they just change the rules about what it means to be profitable? Why wouldn't they just change gap accounting? Therefore, they could never go bust. They wouldn't need to have a, you know, their P&L could be negative. Who cares? So I, in an extreme, I don't even think that would constrain the bank's profitability. But I definitely don't think the regulations or the capital ratios do, because they've got... they can manipulate their balance sheet to such an extreme. I just don't think the regulators can stay up with all their tricks and shenanigans they can pull to make it seem like they're abiding by the rules when really they're not. So she also points out here, base money, which is the Fed's balance sheet. That's basically bank reserves. That's what we're calling base money. Can be created unilaterally by the Federal Reserve, but it needs one of those three mechanisms to get in the broad economy or the broad money supply. So yeah, what she's talking about here is, again, right on the money. The Fed can take their balance sheet to infinity. Doesn't really matter. That doesn't mean that we're going to have more broad money, regardless of the size of the Fed's balance sheet. In other words, regardless of the amount of base money that we have, because the Fed is dependent on the government spending or the commercial bank lending new dollars into existence and therefore creating more dollars on the balance sheets of non-bank entities in the real economy, because those are the dollars that are actually circulating, chasing goods and services. The bank reserves denominated in dollars that are on the Fed's balance sheet, those are not circulating. That only adds balance sheet capacity to create loans for the banking system. But if they're not balance sheet constrained, then you could take the Fed's balance sheet from 8 trillion to 100 trillion, and it really wouldn't matter. The banks have to take some sort of action, or the government, to make a difference in broad money. Okay, so scrolling down here, now she starts going over this idea of not just saying, does the national debt matter for a country, but how is this debt denominated in the country's own currency, or is it denominated in a different currency? So, shoot, my highlights might have disappeared here. But the main thing here is if a country, well, let's say Argentina, right, or Turkey would be another good example of this. if they have to buy something or if they have to pay something back in a currency that's not their own, that's, they got problems, big problems. And that's where you're going to often see huge inflation, or you're going to see an outright default on the debt once it gets to kind of 100% debt to GDP. That's kind of the line in the sand here that Dr. Lacey Hunt has talked about a lot, and that Lynn will reference later on down in the article, is once we get past that point, if a lot of this debt is denominated in a different currency, often that will mean an actual default on the debt. Now, again, we've seen this in Argentina over and over and over again. Or what ends up happening is if it's something they have to buy, like Turkey has to buy oil, well, they need dollars. Okay, well, if they don't have the dollar cash flow coming in, then they have to buy the dollars. How do they buy it? They print Turkish lira to go into the FX market to buy the dollars they need to buy the oil, because the oil producers won't accept Turkish lira. So that creates a lot more supply of lira, a lot more demand for the dollar. And what does the lira do? Hyperinflates, or inflates dramatically. I shouldn't use the word hyperinflate. That's yet to be seen. So then she contrasts this idea with a country that has its national debt denominated in its own currency. So this would be something like the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Japan, China. And in this case, what she points out is that, well, I'll read here because now we're back to my highlights. Basically, when a government debt as a percentage of GDP gets very high, but is denominated in its own currency rather than default in nominal terms, they default with inflation and financial repression. What is financial repression? I think you guys hear that term often. It's really just a fancy way of saying negative real interest rates. So what we have right now in the United States is financial repression, because the CPI, even if you were to believe that, is at 7.5 and the 10-year is trading at 2%. That's a negative real yield. So what financial repression, usually what the central bank will do is try to keep interest rates low while at the same time inflation is running hot. So they're basically stealing from bondholders and they're stealing from savers. That's what financial repression is. And they do that in order to reduce their debt to GDP. So here, and Lynn explains this further. They hold interest rates low, have their central bank create new money to buy bonds, and let inflation run high. Bondholders get paid back, but in weakened currency. As a result, bondholders lose purchasing power on their assets, which is, in macro geeks like me or Lynn, usually say that it's a soft default, but it's still a default. And really cool chart. I noticed that Lynn's doing a lot of her own charts now. So this is the total U.S. debt as a percentage of GDP. And she also goes over CPI adjusted T-bills. So I believe those are tips. And so this is the yield on tips, whether it's, that's on the right here. So you either got a positive yield, you've got a negative yield. She's showing that we got negative yield right now on tips. And then this is the debt to GDP. So she's showing that when the debt to GDP gets really high, at least what we've seen in the United States, the only time we've been this high was during World War II. The playbook for the government is to create negative real rates in order to get that debt to GDP back down. And that's what we saw through the 1940s. And that's what they're attempting to do right now. The big difference here is that the expenses that we had in the 1940s were what I would call one-time costs, or just one-time expenses. Compare that to recurring expenses. And I'm just using kind of entrepreneur terms or business guy terms. And that's how I used to think about my business prior to retiring, or any business that I had. I'd ask myself, you know, what percentage of my costs are fixed and what percentage of my costs fluctuate, or what percentage of my costs are recurring and what percentage are non-recurring. So going back to looking at the United States as a business in 1945, we'll call it, when debt to GDP was 120%, The reason it was 120% because we took on so many one-time expenses or non-recurring expenses. So after the war is over, you don't have those, you don't have to buy tanks anymore. You don't have to pay for a war. So the deficits will naturally go down because your fixed costs were low. The cost increase was due to a fluctuating cost. Where now, I would argue, the vast majority of our deficits and our government spending is fixed. Therefore, the likelihood of seeing this curve, even with financial repression, I would argue is incredibly low. And Lynn gets into that further down the article. I mean, all these charts are fantastic. So I don't have time to go through them all, guys, but I would strongly encourage doing so if you get some time tonight. Then she points out, however, market participants that are familiar with this history have been less surprised by the outcome. And the history she's talking about is how usually governments that have debt in their own currency, their path of least resistance is to try, and we talked about Japan there, try to create inflation, this financial repression to lower their debt to GDP. She talks about, for instance, Reinhardt and Sprencia. I think Reinhardt, I know, is a very famous economist. I'm not sure about this other person. Published a working paper for the IMF back in 2015 called Liquidation of Government Debt that outlined much of the process that the developed world is now going through with deeply negative inflation-adjusted interest rates. And this was actually an updated 2011 paper. Okay, so then she goes on to quote what they're saying in here, but basically it's the exact same thing that we just talked about. Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
So then she goes on to try to grapple with this question, how much national debt is actually too much? Then she points out, when a country gets to about 100% debt to GDP, the situation becomes nearly unrecoverable. Those are the words that she's using. And I can tell you that Lynn is not a hyperbolic type of person. So if she is using the word unrecoverable, that's a big deal. That's a very big deal. And then here she goes on to clarify. What I meant by unrecoverable is there is a vanishingly small probability that the bonds will be able to avoid default and pay interest rates that are higher than the prevailing rate of inflation. In other words, those bonds will most likely begin to lose a meaningful amount of purchasing power for those creditors who lent money to those governments one way or another. Meaning an honest default, where they just say, you know what, we're paying you back 50 cents on the dollar, or a dishonest default, where they say, we're just going to inflate away the purchasing power of what you own or what we owe you. More specifically, a study by Hirsch Capital noted that out of 51, and this is fascinating, guys, check this out. A study by Hirschman Capital noted that out of 51 cases of government debt breaking above 130% of GDP, which is where we were or are now in the United States, since 1800, 50 of the 51 governments have defaulted. The only exception so far is Japan, which she points out is the largest creditor nation in the world. That's a big, big deal, guys, because that means they export far more than they import. So that strengthens the currency. That creates demand for the currency. Where in the United States, it's the opposite. We are a debtor nation. And one of the things that means is that our trade, we don't have a trade surplus, we have a trade deficit. So when we import goods on net balance, we are exporting dollars, where Japan is importing dollars. And that creates a constant bid for the yen, regardless of their debt to GDP. And another thing that I don't know if she points out in this article, but she's pointed out many times in the past, is that although Japan has this 250% debt to GDP, their broad money supply has grown very slowly over the last, call it 10 years. And in fact, more slowly than any other major economy or developed economy. So, you know, when you've got the United States broad money supply increasing by 25% in 2020 alone, that's tough to compare on an apples to apples to Japan. Then she goes on to say, there's no example I can find of a large country with more than 100% government debt to GDP where the central bank doesn't own a significant chunk of the debt. Central banks quickly increase their holdings of government debt when the debt gets that large relative to the size of the economy. And this is exactly what we've seen with the U.S. and the Fed's balance sheet just exploding, buying what? Buying government debt. Just like if you study history, you could have predicted very, very easily. And I think one of Lynn's main takeaways here is to point out that although the Fed may temporarily reduce the size of their balance sheet, when a country gets to this level of debt to GDP, especially, I would add, when the majority of their expenses are fixed, there's almost no chance that the balance sheet of the central bank over time doesn't grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. And the government has to issue more and more and more of those treasuries, which flood the market, which then you just get this feedback loop, which causes the central banks to buy even more of those treasuries. Then the question becomes, what is happening to broad money supply during that time? And what is happening to the supply of goods and services? Because as you guys know, and what we've witnessed since 2020, is it's not, when we're trying to think of consumer price inflation, we can't just think about aggregate demand. We can't just think about the amount of currency units. We also have to think about the access to stuff. And if the access to stuff goes down significantly, regardless of what's happening to aggregate demand, we can still see a significant consumer price inflation. In other words, a devaluing of the purchasing power of from savers and bondholders, or a soft default. So here's another fascinating chart that Lynn uses from the Congressional Budget Office. And this is total deficit, primary deficit, and net interest. So the main takeaway is they're saying that the total deficit as a percentage of GDP got to 15% in 2020. Now, I would argue that it was actually a lot higher than this. I think this is based on a projection during 2020. And the reason I say it was higher is because the national debt went up by like $5 trillion. So, I mean, just back of the napkin math, if the debt goes up by $5 trillion, then that was our deficit. Maybe I'm crazy. Maybe that's too simplistic a view. But assuming that the national debt went up by $5 trillion, and that's more representative of the deficit, then that would mean our deficit was closer to, what, call it 25%. I think that's more accurate. But then we look at 2021 here, and I think this was their projection. So it's only projecting that in 2021 we were at, call it a 7%. When you look at the deficit compared to the GDP, and it was way higher than that. I mean, just say it was $3 trillion. Our GDP is only at, what, 22, 23, something like that. So we were over 10% there. So this my point here is this line in reality probably goes a lot lower. And it does go up, if you guys can follow my arrow, but it doesn't go up this high. It will most likely be here. And then it will probably go up to maybe here before it starts going back down like this. And that's what I'm talking about, guys, how once we get to that point, it's almost a guarantee that the Fed's balance sheet is going to increase. The amount of debt to GDP is going to continue to increase. You get into a Japan type of scenario where the central bank has to buy pretty much all the treasuries. And then it's just a question of how does that cross current along with everything else that's going on, such as trade deficit, trade surplus, how does that play into the broad money supply or the dollars that are on the non-bank entities? And then you've got to think of things in global terms as well. It's not just about what's happening in the United States. When we're talking about the dollar, we're basically talking about the global currency. So what's happening with dollar-denominated debt? What's happening with the dollar against other fiat currencies and those entities' ability to pay back their dollar-denominated debt? You see, right now, the Dixie's at what, 96? So that means a lot of these countries, most likely, that have extreme dollar debts, it's tough for them to pay it back. If the Dixie gets down to 70, well, that's a different ballgame. Now, all of a sudden, it's a lot easier. So if they're paying down their dollar-denominated debt and not taking on more, let's say they're doing more business with Russia and China, therefore the global dollar-denominated debt goes down, that's another cross current that we would have to consider when we're trying to predict if this curve right here would infect or how this curve would affect the actual prices that you're paying at the grocery store. This is another great chart. Federal government current receipts relative to their expenditures. And this is a percentage of GDP, if I'm not mistaken. So you see that, you know, expenditures, total expenditures went up to, you know, well over 45%, but yet tax receipts were only 18%, which is consistent. And this is why I always say, guys, tax rates, you know, the Elizabeth Warren types like to say that all we have to do is increase taxes. It's nonsense, because no matter how high the taxes are, people just don't pay it. Well, there's always loopholes in the tax system to where, you know, back here in the 1970s, you have a 80% highest marginal rate. In the 1980s, you have a 25% marginal rate. And the amount of tax revenue in relation to GDP is still the same. So Lynn's point here, I think, is that we can't expect to be bailed out by just increasing taxes alone, which I totally agree with. It's something I've been saying on my whiteboard videos for a long, long time. Here's another formula that she points out that really illustrates how dire the situation is for the United States and any country, really, that gets themselves into this bind, and how unlikely it is for them to reach escape velocity, if you will, to really kind of get out of this problem just through economic growth. And it's just a very simple equation here. GDP equals consumption plus government expenditure, government spending, investment, and net exports. Well, we know in the United States, that's always going to be a ding against our GDP because ours is always negative with our huge trade deficit and whatnot. But she points out that, okay, so you increase taxes. All right, well, that's going to decrease consumption. And what do? You cut government spending? Okay, well, that's going to lower GDP as well. And then what do? Increase regulations? Okay, well, now you're going to reduce investment. So how do you get this GDP growth, this real GDP growth that you need? It's almost impossible to do, especially when you're a net importer or you run these huge trade deficits. It's almost impossible to do. That's her point with this very simple formula. Here she's talking about negative real rates again, and I'm scrolling through. You guys, again, can see how incredible this article is and how thorough. Now she's talking about infrastructure spending and how this can be a good thing, but usually it's number one, the government isn't going to invest prudently, in my opinion, but it depends on how much infrastructure is already there. Like she points out that the interstate highway system in the 1950s moved the needle huge, and it did. That's because we didn't have any highways. You know, you can talk about fixing bridges all you want, which is what she's talking about here. And that's not going, although that's a good thing, it's not going to increase productivity to the degree to which building highways that did not exist before will increase productivity. So we can't, her point here, I believe, is that we, although there could be some infrastructure spending that could be good, that ain't going to bail us out. And that's just going to increase the government debt, which makes the problem worse. Now she's using examples of taxation, and she's pointing out kind of what she was saying in that other chart, that you can tax the rich all you want, and are you taxing corporations? There's a lot of nuance in there, but usually what that's led to is you know, something that I've been thinking about a lot. And you know, I had a conversation with a gentleman today, brilliant macro guy. His name is Alfonso. He's at Macro Alf on Twitter. And he was talking about how real wages are so negative right now because, yes, wages have gone up in the United States, but not as fast as inflation. So you got to think about if you are the average Joe and Jane, poor middle class, you don't own assets. So your purchasing power has dramatically gone down since 2020, even with stimmy checks. But yet the purchasing power of the people that did own assets has gone up tremendously, at very least stayed consistent with the rate of inflation. So you've got this deeper and deeper and deeper divide. The problem there is that if fewer and fewer of the people are holding the wealth, then it's even harder to increase tax revenue, because those wealthy few are so wealthy that they can really circumnavigate the system. And you say, oh, George, that's wrong. They shouldn't do it. Well, fine. You can bitch and moan about it all you want, but it is what it is. Here, and this is Lynn's point. But in practice, corporatism and governments are intertwined. Policy is crafted from key lobbying input. My article on wealth concentration went into this detail on some of the fiscal choices that led to the current situation. So her point there is, yeah, you guys, you can raise tax all you want, or try to, or on paper that might work, but in reality it's not, because now we basically have fascism, and it's even being pushed more so by the global elite and the Davos types, the World Economic Forum, IMF, etc. And corporations aren't, because they have so much political pull, because we have capitalism, but we do not have free market capitalism. Big difference there. And because these corporations have so much pull with the government, the probability of increasing taxes on those entities is incredibly low. And she's saying that it doesn't really matter. Republican people think that Republicans always do better. They don't. In fact, they do worse when you look at deficits and whatnot. So just being able to vote someone in like Trump, you know, listen, there's no president that's going to save us from this. At the end of the day, they're all politicians, and most of them are completely incompetent. I think that's Lynn's point here. So we conclude with the question, the initial question. So does national debt really matter? And for this, I'm just going to read her whole conclusion. The short answer is yes, national debt matters even when it's denominated in a country's own currency. However, the way in which it can matter depends on specific details. When the debt is not denominated in a country's own currency, the government risks actual nominal default. They handle their finances poorly. On the other hand, when the debt is denominated in their own currency, the government almost always ends up printing the difference. Holding interest rates below the prevailing inflation rate and using capital controls and other restrictions to corral market participants into devaluing assets. So they screw the average Joe and Jane. It's exactly what they did during World War II in the 1940s. The result is that bondholders and cash savers lose a big chunk of their purchasing power despite technically getting paid back. It's a soft default via inflation and financial repression. Fiscal prudence is important when debt is low because it helps prevent getting into the situation in the first place. I'm paraphrasing there. And this is not just in terms of how much spending and taxation are used, but also what types of spending and taxation. Is money being spent on defense, long-term productivity improvements? Is the tax arrangement suitable to entice employers to come to a country and hire domestic workers? Is the current social contract of the country relatively balanced, or is it out of whack with high levels of cronyism? Is what we say here. And that's why I conclude every single video by saying not just freedom, liberty, not just capitalism, but free market capitalism. Free market capitalism is not corporatism. It's not cronyism. It's the opposite of that. Once government debt is beyond around 100% of GDP, range of prudent policies get narrower and narrower. Navigating policies is always a challenging from an investor standpoint. Investors tend to be overly optimistic when their preferred political party is in power and overly pessimistic when their preferred political party is out of power. They tend to let their own political preferences shape their views on economic growth and inflation. Even their views are not necessarily backed up by evidence or history. And this is why I always say, guys, it's not about political parties here. This is not about red or blue or any of that nonsense. I dislike both parties equally. Right now, we're talking from a freedom standpoint. I think it's are you an authoritarian or are you someone who believes in freedom? Those are the two groups that we're dealing with right now. But it's still, this is solutions for the problems we have in the world today are not going to come from the top down. They're going to come from the bottom up. And there's nothing that illustrates this better than the truckers. You can hire your guy, your gal to be president or anything like that. And sure, that might do a couple things fine, but nothing is going to move the needle like the truckers, meaning a decentralized approach where they're just standing up for freedom and liberty. At the end of the day, we matter. We matter. The people, not the politicians. She talking about investors. She says that our overweight cash and bonds, multiple currencies likely to be debased on a persistent basis throughout the 2020 decade. Although naturally there will be some years where holding those assets can provide protection against downturns in prices of volatile assets, such as the stock market and housing. We talked about that in 2020 with the potential inversion of the curve. And maybe me, I'm keeping a little bit more cash than I normally would, even though there's a negative carry because I want the optionality. Cash and bonds are, in that sense, a very expensive form of optionality and volatility reduction and little else. And I would completely agree. I'm just holding this cash position, not, you know, I've got to kind of hold my nose to do it because I know that it's usually not prudent because I've got such a negative carry. But again, just with this circumstance we're dealing with Fed raising rates, I'm willing to kind of roll the dice temporarily. All right, guys, there you go. That was the incredible article from my good friend and business partner, Miss Lynn Alden. So check that out at her website, lynnalden.com. I'm sure it'll open up your mind and give you a lot of food for thought that we can discuss in future videos. So as always, make sure that you're standing up for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism. And I'll see you on the next video.